Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists. Craig Venter, Chairman and President, J. Craig Venter Institute. David Hawkins, Director, Climate Center, Natural Resources Defense Council. Anne Lauvergeon, Chairman of the Executive Board and CEO, Areva. Ogunlade Davidson, Professor, University of Sierra Leone. And our moderator, John Holdren, Director, Woods Hole Research Center, Teresa and John Hines Professor of Environmental Policy, Harvard University.
Good morning, and thank you all for coming. The term global warming is a misnomer. It implies something that is uniform, gradual, and quite possibly benign. But what the world is experiencing is none of those. What the world is experiencing is uneven, rapid, and overwhelmingly negative for human well-being. To be accurate, what we really ought to be calling it is accelerating global climatic disruption. The stated goal of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which has been ratified now by 191 countries, including, I should emphasize, the United States, is to, quote, avoid dangerous anthropogenic interference in the climate system, close quote. In my opinion, that goal is already out of reach. The world is already experiencing dangerous interference in the climate system. It's manifested in increases in floods, droughts, heat waves, wildfires, coral bleaching, tropical forest drying, permafrost thawing, sea level rising, and much more. The goal now has to be to avoid catastrophic interference in the global climate system. In the situation we face, there are only three options: mitigation, steps you take to reduce the pace and the magnitude of the climate change that occurs; adaptation, steps you take to reduce the damages that result from the degree of climate change you're unable to avoid; and suffering. It's important to understand that we're already doing some of all three. We're mitigating, we're adapting, and we're suffering already. We're going to do more of all three. The only question now is what the proportions are going to be. And the more mitigation we do, the better the chances that adaptation to what cannot be avoided will be able to hold the suffering to levels that are short of completely catastrophic. It's increasingly clear that the amount of mitigation that will be needed to achieve a good chance of avoiding catastrophe is going to entail stabilizing the atmospheric concentration of greenhouse gases at a level equivalent to about 450 parts per million of carbon dioxide. That means that global emissions of carbon dioxide in particular need to peak no later than 2015 to 2020 and need to be declining steadily after that. Getting that done is going to be a huge challenge. Three-quarters of the annual emissions of carbon dioxide come from burning the coal, oil, and natural gas that currently supply more than 80% of the world's energy. Most of the remaining quarter comes from tropical deforestation. And neither the world's energy system nor the forces that are driving tropical deforestation can be changed easily, and particularly cannot be changed quickly. There is no silver bullet, no single measure, no single strategy that is powerful enough to meet the mitigation challenge. But the challenge can be met and can be met affordably if we use a silver shotgun, if we embrace a wide variety of actions across an array of fronts. Our distinguished panel today is going to tell us about some of those fronts and about what actions are required. I want to start with Ogunlade Davidson. Ogun, you are one of the co-chairs of IPCC Working Group 3. That's the working group focused on the mitigation of climate change. You're also one of the leading energy experts in the world from the South. So I have a two-part question for you. First, what is the essence of what Working Group 3 of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has concluded about the mitigation challenge and what we need to do to meet it? And the second part of the question is, how do you see that challenge being linked with the development challenge from the standpoint of the South?
Thank you, John. Let me start by thanking the Clinton Initiative for giving me the time to share one or two words with you. Now, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change have just finished the fourth assessment report. And if I should put the summary of the fourth assessment reports, we have three groups. The working group one, which is the science, which clearly tells us that we are not doing well. The second group tells us that what we are doing will cause significant impact, which you already outlined. Now, the third group is telling us that we can do something about it. However, we may need to change the way we do business. There are a lot of things that we can do, essentially the different types of technologies that are available, the different types of technology that would be available and commercialized by 2030 in the near term, and some by the year 2100. These technologies, provided that we have the right political environment so that the policies that we to sort of move these technologies forward are there, we also need significant amounts of investment so that we can introduce these technologies as widely as possible all over the world. These would help us to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases that we put in the atmosphere. As you rightly did mention, the report went through a range of stabilization. Now, if we got to achieve the 450, then the 450 need to be achieved by peaking, and then we move slowly, and that has to be done by between 2015 and the year 2020. And that means that we've got to change the investment pattern now. So in short, if I should summarize what the fourth assessment report is saying, it's clearly time is up. We've got to act now.
And how about the link to development, Hogan?
Now, this is a very important challenge. What the report is trying to say that, in that aspect, is that sustainable development and climate change mitigation provide opportunity for us to do things differently. And we cannot accept the idea that trying to mitigate for climate change means that you've got to sacrifice development. There are different types of development paths, and those development paths would help us to move in a more sustainable fashion. Just take an example of just the way we live in our various houses, the way we build our houses. We can still have the same comfort in the house that we want to be in, but we just build our house differently. We just change the habits that of how we do things. And so therefore, the report is clearly telling you we don't need to sacrifice development because we want to solve the climate change problem. There are several options that we can use to do that.
Good. David Hawkins, you lead the climate work of the Natural Resources Defense Council. It's one of the most respected environmental NGOs in the world, not least because the NRDC works on solutions and not just on pointing to problems. I know that you personally have been deeply involved in looking for solutions to address the 40% of global fossil fuel emissions that come from burning coal, the 40% of CO2 emissions from fossil fuels that come from burning coal. Most of that burned in generating about 40% of the world's electricity. What is your current take on what we can do about all that carbon dioxide coming from coal now and under the worldwide expansion of coal use that just about everybody predicts? And what do we need to do right now to get started on that problem?
Thanks, John. Let me run through a number of truths about coal and climate. The first is we can't solve the climate problem unless we change the way we use coal. The second is we're facing a juggernaut of new coal plant investments in the next couple of decades that we have to deal with right now. We don't have 15 years to address this problem. We don't have 10 years to address this problem. We need an action plan now, today. Every 3 days, a new coal plant starts up somewhere in the world. Every 3 days, a large new coal plant. That coal plant is going to have an operating life of 60 to 80 years. And those long operating lives, together with the fact that they are not designed to do anything with their CO2, makes them climate killers. We've got to do something about it. Vice President Gore told us yesterday that the Arctic ice sheet may be gone in 23 years. in that same 23-year period, new coal plant construction will more than double the operating coal power plants in the world. And the lifetime global warming pollution from those roughly two decades worth of investments, it's an astounding figure, will release more carbon dioxide than has been released from all prior human use of coal for 20 years of investments. The next fact that we need to think about are solutions. There are three big things that we can do to avoid this investment in business as usual coal. The first is energy efficiency, and you're going to hear tomorrow about a huge energy efficiency opportunity, green buildings. Think of green buildings as the anti-coal plant. The second is renewable energy. Renewable energy, wind, solar, biomass, again, huge opportunities. It's going to be discussed this afternoon. Anne is going to talk about another option, which is nuclear, and I won't talk about that. I'll let her talk about it. The third is carbon capture and storage from fossil fuel power plants. Well, what's that all about? Well, it is technically feasible to capture the carbon from coal plants and inject it into geologic formations. This is commercially demonstrated technologies, but it's not in use today because we don't have the policy mechanism to create a market demand for it to be used. So what do we need to do? Well, in industrial countries, we think we need to adopt performance standards to make sure that no new coal plants are built without carbon capture and storage. In California has already adopted such a law, and there are bills in Congress which would adopt those provisions as well. We need to get them made the law of the land here and in other countries. For developing countries, we think we need an international fund that will cover all or part of the incremental costs of building and operating any coal plants that are built with carbon capture and storage. You might think that's a break-the-bank proposition, but it isn't. Our calculations are you could cover the next 20 years of power plants in the developing world for an impact on OECD electricity prices of 2 or 3%. If we do that, we can preserve headroom in the atmosphere. And so we shouldn't be thinking about this as charity. This is an investment. It's an investment in reducing the overall mitigation cost of a climate protection program over the next several decades. The final thing that I would say is in the 1980s, I got myself arrested for picketing the South African embassy. I was one person whose behavior and thoughts were affected by a worldwide realization that business as usual investments in the apartheid regime were ethically unacceptable. I think we have to think about new business as usual coal investments through that ethical frame. These power plants will kill people. And in addition to these practical solutions, there's enormous power in getting the ethics right. If we get the ethics right, we'll unleash the forces to make the economics work.
Thank you. Anne Loverzone, you are the CEO of the largest nuclear energy company in the world, indeed one of the largest energy companies, and I know it does more than just nuclear, Areva. Your country, France, gets something like 80% of its electricity from nuclear energy, while the world as a whole only gets about 17%. From nuclear energy. Given that nuclear energy production does not release carbon dioxide, the growing recognition of the climate change challenge has led to something of a resurgence in interest in the prospects for expanding nuclear energy around the world. And yet, some say that costs, safety, wastes, and proliferation are significant obstacles to that. I wonder if you could draw some lessons from your experience in Areva and in France, both about the rationale for a nuclear renaissance and about how the world should think about those obstacles.
Thank you, John, for your questions. First of all, let me be clear on one point. I will be not the nuclear for everybody, everywhere, a woman of this panel. I think that nuclear is a very powerful source of electricity for sophisticated countries, and it's not the solution to fight against climate change globally. But I think that we have no global solution without nuclear now. Why? Because now the use of nuclear avoids a lot of emission of CO2, and that, well, as you said, if we come to let's come to nuclear energy. You pointed out proliferation, waste, and cost as the dark side of nuclear energy, as opposed to CO2-free for the bright side of nuclear energy. But I will take your arguments one by one. Does nuclear energy facilitate nuclear weapon proliferation? First, as you know, military use of nuclear has historically preceded the civil use. It is true for all the five nuclear states of non-proliferation treaty. The bombs, the nuclear bombs now exist. We will not disinvent it. And this means that if you stop use of nuclear energy, it will change anything to possible proliferation. And if we look the main proliferators, historical proliferators, they don't produce 1 kilowatt hour with nuclear. So the two phenomena are largely separated. And we know now, with IAEA special control, that it is very easy to make sure that a nuclear plant cannot be used for proliferation use. But it means that for the fuel cycle, we have to be much more careful. And it's clear that economically, you don't need a fuel cycle in a country if you want to develop civilian use of nuclear. Second step, nuclear waste. What we know now, industrially, is to recycle 96% of the spent fuel. And if I take the French example, that's clear that all the nuclear waste produced by EDF during 40 years, the volume of these residues is the volume of this room. And of course, the obvious things to do with those residues is to put them into a geological deposit to make sure that it will not be used in the future. Lastly, the cost issue. It's a very past issue, I may say. Historically, especially in the US, the nuclear plants were not used properly, so it means they have worked during 10 years or 15 years only 70% of the possibilities. Now, even in the US, they are used at 90, 92, 95%. It means that it is a very good business, and it explains the lifetime extensions we are making now in the US. And it's very attractive now for the utilities to develop new nuclear. Why? Because it is at predictable cost. You know perfectly well the cost of such an energy in 60 years from now, because uranium is entering only for 5% of the cost of the kilowatt hour. So globally, I think that nuclear energy is a part of the answer. Part of the answer, especially in OECD countries. If you take only these OECD countries, if you add only 4 new nuclear plants, new EPRs, in each OECD countries, we could globally get the Kyoto targets. Of course, it's not the answer for, it's also a part of the answer for developing countries like India, like China, like Brazil, and so on, but not for the small ones or the less advanced ones. So it means that what we have to think also is a burden sharing of who, which country has to make the efforts and when.
Thank you. Craig Venter, you are one of the pioneers of genomic science, and in that domain you made your reputation by thinking and doing outside the box, doing things that others said were impossible or impractical. I know you've been thinking for some time now about energy and climate, and again, presumably outside the box. I wonder if you would tell us what the main leverage points are that you have been thinking about and working on in terms of the relation between biology and the great mitigation challenge that we face. And what do we need to do now and soon to get those leverage points into action?
Well, thank you for your question. It's a pleasure to be here today. As a biological scientist, I'd like to think we have better choices than choosing our poison of CO2 versus nuclear waste. And most of the thinking I've seen in this field has been based on people looking backward and trying to extrapolate forward based on the thinking from the past. All the oil and coal that we have is all result of ancient biology. Our atmosphere, our oxygen that we breathe, is a result of ancient and current biology. Biology is the only thing that actually works at the scale to reverse the problem that we've created as a species. We're still learning about biology on the planet. For the last 10 or 15 years, we've been digitizing biology by sequencing the genetic code of multiple species, including our own. Earlier this year, we reported just from taking water samples from the ocean that just over a third of the ocean, a single tract in a sailboat, we discovered 6 million new genes and literally hundreds of thousands of new species that provide metabolisms that we've never even seen or thought about before. And this is a tiny fraction. Discoveries in a linear phase right now. Part of these discoveries, we discovered new ways that organisms capture light energy from the sun and convert that into electrical, biological energy within cells, not photosynthesis, a totally different processing. We've announced earlier this year programs with our new company, Synthetic Genomics, with BP, looking at conversion of subsurface carbons using biology, for example, converting coal into methane or other metabolites, the same way we can try and metabolize plant debris. But part of this, and David mentioned sequestered CO2, we have tens of thousands of organisms that convert CO2 into methane with no organic substances required. So we're looking at actually converting sequestered CO2 back into natural gas, which creates a convertible cycle. We have, through synthetic genomics now, we can go from reading the genetic code to writing it. We're very close to the first synthetic species, but this allows us a whole new way of thinking of converting biology into practical solutions, but writing the genetic code of new species to do what we want. Now, people have looked for organisms forever to produce hydrogen or methane. Biology produces everything. We have organisms that produce basically diesel fuel. We can get octane. Any basic fuel that's come out of oil and coal, we can get from biology. Nothing evolved to do it at the scale that we want. But through genomics and through these biological techniques, we can change metabolism up to a million-fold. So this is a new area. There's been very little investment in it. Fortunately, there's a lot of private capital going into this area. We now, through these synthetic processes, have a new fuel substitute that we think will be a new possible green jet fuel. We have it in testing now to see if it's going to be a good substitute for ethanol and butanol. These are just early stages. There's lots of people starting to work in this area, but there's very little our government or other governments are doing. We're totally dependent on private investment. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have time for about 1 minute each on redirect, so I'm going to ask a quick additional questions to each of you. Ogun, many people have said that the cleanest, fastest, cheapest, safest route to climate change mitigation is improving the efficiency with which energy is used, the end use side of the picture. Not much has been said about that so far. Do you think that solution applies in the less developed countries as well as in the industrial ones?
I think you're quite right. Energy efficiency can play a very strong part in the entire energy system because the efficiency at which we use energy, we produce energy, we supply energy, is roughly under 40%. And so therefore saving on the 60% would help. But when you look at different sections of the world, in saturated energy economies, which are the developed countries, energy efficiency will play a greater part. in the developing countries that are yet to achieve the saturation of their energy economies. So energy efficiency then would have to be a supply option rather than a utilizing option, because they need to provide the energy to suit their development and also other aspects of the livelihood. So energy efficiency is important. It will play, but it will play in different parts of the world, depending on the saturation of the energy system.
Thank you. David Hawkins, you made a very compelling case that we have no choice but to capture and sequester the carbon dioxide from the coal-burning power plants that will be built around the world in the next few decades. And yet, some people have argued, including the recent MIT study in coal, that the technology for doing that simply isn't going to be ready for 15 or 20 years. I take it you don't agree with that. Would you tell us why you don't agree with it and what we need to do to make sure that those carbon capture and sequestration technologies are, in fact, ready when we need them?
I served on the advisory panel to the MIT study that John is mentioning. What the report says is that we know enough today to safely start storing millions of tons of CO2 in geologic formations. What they pointed out, though, is if you want an optimized system that involves storing billions of tons, there's quite a bit of work that needs to be done. The argument that we make is, yes, that work needs to be done, but it needs to be done in parallel, not in series. We don't have time to do it in series, and we don't have any significant risks associated with doing it in parallel. We're not talking about safety risks here. We're talking about optimizing the system, and the system will get optimized by doing it, not by researching it.
Thank you. Anne Loverjone, the two places in the nuclear energy system that at least in principle are relevant to the proliferation of nuclear weapons are the enrichment plants and the fuel reprocessing plants. In principle, people could use enrichment plants to make highly enriched uranium for bombs. They could use a reprocessing plant to separate plutonium for bombs. Some have said that ultimately the only solution for a greatly expanded nuclear energy presence in the world would be to put those two kinds of facilities, enrichment plants and reprocessing plants, under multinational control. Do you agree with that?
You have had, during the two last years, different initiatives coming from U.S. administration, coming from Russia, coming from IEA, to organize a little bit the themes and to say, okay, nuclear renaissance for a lot of countries, but it means fuel cycle for only a few countries with special organization to make sure that the other countries, having no fuel cycle, will be secured in terms of deliveries. And the IEA initiative is especially interesting. We have worked a lot with IEA on that. In my view, it's it's a pragmatic approach, and I hope that it could be put in place rapidly.
Thank you. Craig Venter, you raised a number of very intriguing possibilities about the future of biology in addressing this problem, and yet the biggest question is how fast, how quickly could some of these possibilities come to scale and start to make a significant dent? In the genomics business, again, you made part of your reputation by doing the sequencing of the human genome much more rapidly than people thought it was possible. How rapidly can we scale up the most attractive options that you're talking about for bringing biology to bear on energy supply?
It's a very critical question, because the scale that we're talking about here exceeds anything else in humanity. And so we don't know the answer of how fast we could truly bring things up to scale to make a big difference. But we should start to get some of the answers for that in the next 2 or 3 years. This is a very rapidly evolving field, and probably is the biggest wild card in the whole bioenergy field.
Well, thank you very much. We have about 45 seconds left in our allotted time. I simply want to say that, understandably, this session has been something of a drink from a fire hydrant. There is a tremendous amount of terrain to be discussed. We've only touched parts of it. But I thank the panel for doing a terrific job of introducing some of these topics. And we'll now be turning to the table discussions for the next half hour, in which the tables will address questions to the panel and come up with their own thoughts on some of these issues in the same mode that we've been using for the past three sessions in this energy and climate workshop. So we will look forward to some exciting input from the tables, and the panel will repair to lick its wounds. Thank you very much.